This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and to expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. I have learned many things about myself doing this podcast over the last 5 years, but I never expected that during an interview, I would find out that I might believe in God. This is my interview with Michael Millerman. I am joined from Montreal by Michael Millerman, who is my hero, actually, and one of the main reasons I started Renegade University right here. I didn't know you at the time, but you and your experience, which I think is representative of a lot of people's experiences, including mine, is a major reason that I formed an alternative university. And you've also introduced me, I think most importantly, to a whole way of thinking, a whole worldview, multiple worldviews that I was previously completely ignorant of, which have been blowing me away lately and have been forcing me in the most amazing ways to just rethink everything from top to bottom. So now that I've teased people about what's going on here, let's just tell your story, because there's a lot in your life and your career that is a great importance to me and of great interest to me, and I think will be for the audience too. So Michael Millerman, you have a little bit of an accent, but you were born where?
I was born in Windsor, Ontario, in Canada. My family had left Chisinev, Moldova, from the former Soviet Union in 1980, and I was born in 1983, so Canadian born and raised. But the link to a Russian-speaking background had some effect on the development of my life, because I later wanted to learn Russian better than I had learned it in the house. So I took some Russian at the university level and became interested at one point in the distinctly Russian tradition of religious thought, religious mysticism, and religious philosophy, which set me down an unexpected path later in my studies. But yeah, I was born in Canada.
A very dangerous path too. But so you were, and we'll get to that, of course, but you're born in Canada and your parents are Moldovan immigrants.
Yeah, my dad is Jewish, so he's a Soviet Jew, and my mom comes from a German background, so they're the Volga Russians who were invited to live in the Russian Empire that moved from Germany, and you could just say like a couple of Soviet, even though my dad is Soviet Jew, they're both basically atheists, Soviet atheists,
and they
came to Canada, and I was born, you know, no religion in the house, nothing like that, basically more or less typical Soviet parents. I don't know if people know what's typical there. But yeah, that's the situation.
What's a typical Soviet parent?
Well, little things. Like people celebrate Christmas. December 25th, you celebrate Christmas. You have Santa Claus and you have your Christmas tree. Well, in the Soviet tradition, you don't do the 25th, you do the 31st. It's not Christmas, it's the New Year. It's not a Christmas tree, it's a New Year's tree, and it's not Santa Claus, it's Old Man Winter. But everything else is pretty much the same. So there's like these, no, you know, those kinds of things. They're just typical in the case of a Russian household.
Is that what this, I didn't know this. I've studied Soviet history. I didn't know, is that what they did to Christmas?
Well, that's what it was like in our house growing up. But then there's also like the old calendar, the Orthodox Christmas, the one that takes place, you know, 14 days later, whatever the case is. But I just mean to say, we didn't have a lot of religion and politics in the house, pretty hands off in that sense. Okay. But there's still the connection to Russian language somehow, Russian history somehow, Jewish background somehow, German background somehow, but all of that was later to be discovered as opposed to a big part of the household education.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I think you're foreshadowing something here, right? Maybe. So you're talking about sort of ethnic cultural identity being kind of subsumed within the Soviet communist identity?
Yeah, not even, again, like it's not that Soviet ideology or communist ideology was a part in the house. I think you had something like that in your, where that political ideology played a big part of your upbringing, right? Ours was very much like mine and my siblings, it was hands-off ideologically. So it's like we didn't have, just consider a vacuum, you know, a vacuum of politics, ideology, and religion. But with these threads. Yeah. So later in life, when I, like I said, pulled on that Russian language thread a little bit and maybe was attracted to German philosophy and began to discover the transformation of Jewish thought in modernity with thinkers like Spinoza and stuff like that, these threads began to come together that were, you know, never like obviously there in the first place, but somehow always behind the scenes, still shaping things.
Yeah. Okay. So, but back to your parents though, why did they leave, or how did they leave the Soviet Union?
It's a long story, but you know, Jews in the Soviet Union, for my dad's, in the case of my dad, not necessarily getting the best kind of treatment, you know, hammer in the head type thing, and Jews in the Soviet Union. So he got an invitation to leave the way that basically Jews could leave the Soviet Union. And I think 1980 is the year when they got out, and then they went the typical route, which I guess is through like Vienna and then Italy or something, and ended up in Ontario, Canada, where I was born. And then, you know, built a life there, and that's it, basically.
Well, wait, can you imagine being a Soviet immigrant trying to build a life? Well, you can imagine, I guess. In fact, you know about it. Yeah. What on earth did they do for a living when they got there?
So my mom's an automotive engineer,
and
she was very skillful. In fact, I can say that if anybody watching this or yourself really knows about supercars, Ford some number of years ago released their, I guess it's called the F-150 or whatever it is. You know, they reinstated this old supercar. And my mom was the only woman engineer on the team. She did the seatbelt engineering for that car. So she was quite a competent auto engineer. She's not doing that anymore. Now she's, you know, retired, and my dad is retired. He worked in the automotive industry as well. And they just, you know, they grinded. Is that how you say it? Like they worked hard, right? They worked hard to provide for the family. They worked hard in their fields of automotive engineering and all of that. And myself and my siblings did, you know, went through school, somehow typical, although I should say there are atypical moments. So the academic situation that you and I find ourselves in, namely that we do some independent academic work, having been estranged from mainstream institutional academia, the prehistory, I'll just say one word about it here, is that I never was inculcated with the thought that university is the natural outcome of everything that you do. Like a lot of people, they're thinking about going to university from a very young age, and everything they do is geared towards that. And that wasn't my case. I didn't really have university in mind. I wasn't gunning for it. I wasn't thinking too far ahead in the future. I was a bit of a, I had other interests and things like that. And it was only later that the idea of going to university clicked, and then sort of the academic history got started. But prior to that, this is relevant. I was reading a lot of works on like mystical thought, mysticism, comparative mysticism of all kinds, Islamic, Jewish, Christian, psychoanalytic, Jung, tarot, occult, just whatever, you know, whatever was lying around the house and whatever appealed to that dimension of human existence. That's kind of what my major interest was. It wasn't, I want to go get a job, I want to go start a business. It was very much like oriented towards the deep dimensions of human life. And later when I did go to university, it became a question, how do you combine a genuine interest with the foundations and meaning of human existence with the sometimes more superficial routine and rote kind of instruction that happens at the university? It wasn't always obvious that you could combine the rigor of an academic training with an interest in human foundations and things like that.
Wait, a whole mysticism, your first intellectual interest, I take it, right? was mysticism?
Yeah. Yeah. Intellectual and existential.
Okay.
In other words, yeah, it's not just the conceptual exercise, because when you read the account that the mystics give of the experience they regard as the culmination of their life of questing for truth, beauty, and goodness, and divinity, holiness, and all of that, it's not just a conceptual act or operation, although the intellect is involved. It's an all-consuming fire. And that's true, I think, for all of the mystics who write about it. And that was something that was extremely appealing to me, not just as an idea, but as something that you would want to put yourself through. You know what I mean?
Oh, I know nothing about this, my friend. We haven't even talked about this. I know that your work, and we'll get into this, you know, deals with mysticism, but I didn't know it was this central in your life, and especially in your intellectual life. So first of all, I know nothing about mysticism. The history of it, and nothing. So teach me. First of all, how do you define it? What makes someone a mystic?
Okay, here's the simplest first approximation, I think. You read accounts of people who are called mystics, and for the most part, the centerpiece of what they have to say is a direct encounter with God that's not mediated by the natural world. So there is a kind of nature mysticism where you're walking through the woods, or you see the snow blowing through the sky and the light glistening on it, and you have some sort of feeling of profound serenity or sublimity. So there's that kind of thing. But and that's legitimate, that's valid, and you could call that a form of mysticism as well, where you've had some breakthrough to a deeper dimension of existence, either in this unmediated way that you just have like lightning strike inside your soul and you're trying to understand what just happened, what was that lightning, or you heard, or you have like Plotinus, the Neoplatonic mystic, says it's difficult to describe the mystic vision because what you see and what and your act of seeing, it's all one. So it's this sense of a transcendental oneness where you've overcome your subjectivity, your difference, your alterity, yourself, your ego self, and you haven't dissolved it into some sort of nothingness. You have brought it to some sort of beatific vision or some sort of intimate union or encounter with the Almighty. That's roughly the way that it's described and expressed. And something that was incredible to me as I read, for example, Christian mystics, Jewish mystics, Kabbalists, Islamic mystics, and things like that, is this was a key insight actually for me at the time that later mapped over into my academic work. It seemed that everybody was having some kind of fundamental existential experience that they were then turning around and interpreting in terms of the language that was available to them and best known to them from their tradition. So for example, a Christian might come out of the religious experience and say, I'm crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. Or they might say that they had, like the Orthodox mystics do, the mysterious light of Tabor, they experienced it in their souls. Or some other formulation drawn from the language available to them from their Christian readings and doctrines and texts. And likewise, an Islamic mystic would have recourse to figures from Islamic thought, Jewish tradition would have recourse to figures from Jewish thought. So that observation gave me the complex interplay between interpretation, the interpretation of the experience in the language that's available to the person who had it, and some encounter that seems to break through to a more fundamental level. So that sort of back and forth, like going to the foundations and coming back out and trying to talk about it. Now, the reason I say that's relevant to my later academic work is because in part, I did something like that in my dissertation study, where I did a comparative study of receptions of Heidegger by political philosophers. That's like structurally analogous, roughly, to a comparative study of various mystical traditions on the basis of their encounter with God. Here, it's the comparative study of various political theory traditions on the basis of their encounter with Heidegger. How do they get that encounter, come out of it, and put it in terms that are available to them, that are familiar to them, and make sense of it? And another one is like the extent. So imagine that you could go to the Holy of Holies, so to speak, to the inner citadel. Okay, you have the key that unlocks the last door in a sequence of doors. So in other words, there's like a scale of intensity of the proximity to the absolute or whatever, okay? Like a degree of mystical illumination. Mm-hmm. So somebody, for example, made it into the inner courtyard and didn't make it further. And then they say, you know what? There is nothing further. Okay, that's like you can understand the logic, the psychological logic and the spiritual logic of that. They made it one step. They didn't make it the next step. So they spurn or spite the idea that there could be anything further. And then they just treat the outer courtyard or the inner courtyard as the end of the story. It's kind of similar, in my view, with Heidegger, for example. So some people look at it. They try to get through to the meaning of Heidegger's teaching. They get blocked or stuck in the outer courtyard or in the inner courtyard or somewhere. And then they say, there must not be anything else going on there. They turn around and they establish some other teaching or doctrine. So it's sort of like that whole complicated interplay between teaching, interpretation, and our ability to get into the heart of things, the intensity of our access to the teaching. That's like a key theme before and after academia, with and without Heidegger. But it started with those mystical authors.
Okay. You are presuming that there is a heart of the matter, right? You're presuming, I take it, that there is something deeper. You're presuming, it sounds like, that when they say they had an encounter with God, you believe that.
So my view is that we don't need to presume that they did or that they didn't. You could try to explain away the accounts in some other light, some other perspective. So you could say, this is just a return to the experience of being in the womb where everything is an undifferentiated oneness and so on. But the way of reading that I think offers the most is, number one, kind of like a phenomenology of the mystical experience, which means actually trying to understand as much as possible what they're claiming and the basis on which they're claiming it. Is there any legitimacy to those kinds of linguistic, hermeneutic, conceptual operations that would force us at the outset to interpret them psychologically or in terms of evolutionary biology or whatever the case is? So number one is like the intention of reading them as though they could be true. Are they consistent? Do they make sense? What concepts are we bringing to the text? So the whole problem now, not just of their interpretation of the experience they had, but of our task as readers of their interpretation. So the whole problem of how do you read carefully in a meaningful way without distorting it, somebody's account of their own encounter with what they call the truth or the source of their insights. And that's another big piece of the puzzle. So my approach to the text is, we don't want to dogmatically consider them true at the outset, and we don't want to dogmatically consider them untrue at the outset, meaning we have to have an approach to the texts that is open to the possibility that they did have that, we can learn from it, and it's feasible, which is why I say that my original interest in mysticism was more than just intellectual. It would have to include an existential dimension, because so many of the authors say, for example, they say, I'll just give you an example, okay? We meditated and fasted for 20 days, and then we repeated this prayer for whatever, 20 hours, right? And then we felt the warm glow in our heart, for example. So now imagine you read something like that and you say, okay, what might I have to do to be a competent judge of that claim? Am I actually a competent judge if I haven't done those things? Well, maybe. Now, it doesn't mean everybody has to do it. But what now if I find 10 other mystics who also claimed that as a result of having done that, they, you know, as a result of having done X, they experienced Y? So I thought, like, okay, this is, you have to throw yourself into it. If you really want to grasp it, at least you have to throw yourself into other people's account of it as you try to make sense of it. You see? Okay. So that, so, I just want to add, this idea of throwing ourselves into something we don't understand to try to make sense of it, that basic principle, not discounting it at the outset, you see it plays out in my later interests in some thinkers who are not considered mainstream.
Indeed. And this is why we know each other, by the way. That's how we came together, right? By doing that in our own separate respective fields, right? We were interested in things you weren't supposed to be interested in. And we took seriously things you weren't supposed to take seriously. Back to mysticism, though. I'm not done interrogating you on this. So the, okay. So what you found, is this correct? You found mystics across regions, across cultures, across the world, right? That you're saying,
and across time,
and you're saying that you found commonality among them. You found some common threads. They said similar things about their experience with God.
Yes. Yes.
Holy shit, man.
Yeah. And that was
okay.
There's that I mean, first of all, it's amazing because it suggests the possibility of a trans-historical fundamental experience of human encounter with something greater than ourselves.
Right? Yikes. Say that again.
Say that again. So it suggests the possibility of a trans-historical, meaning it's not just a matter of 21st century late capitalism or something like that, right? It's in principle accessible to man as man at any given time, given the kind of being that we are, to transcend some limitation or horizon or cross some threshold and encounter or meet. I mean, how you say it becomes possibly here either inviting or disinviting, depending on who hears it. But, right, some fundamental experience of transcending ourselves in the direction of something greater, and not just greater. Like if I transcend myself in the direction of the nation, or I transcend myself in the direction of the international working class,
right,
that's a kind of horizontal self-transcendence. I'm getting beyond myself to some other social category, big or small. But we're talking about a vertical self-transcendence. We're talking about a transcendence in the direction of either, you know, downward in Heideggerian language to the ground of our existence, or upward in another type of topography to the, you know, source, to the to the beginning of, so that kind of thing. And it was amazing. It did not seem like the kind of experience you would just want to discount too quickly, given its importance and given the attestation.
My friend, I mean, you might have found evidence of the existence of God.
Well, look.
Yes, that's what's happening here.
It's more, it seems blasphemous to say it's more than that, you know, but yeah, that's there. Different people could derive different insights, cynical or genuine, on the basis of, you know, what I've just described. Because even if you say no, none of that tells you anything about the existence or lack of existence of God. Let's suppose that. Okay. No, mystical experience tells us nothing about the existence or non-existence of God. Okay. It tells us something about the possibilities of human existence, that we could have an experience that we interpret in those terms. So at the very least, we want to try to understand, in my view, what does that tell us about the possibilities of human existence? Maybe the interpretation is wrong, that it's an encounter with God in the, you know, in the radical rejection of that.
Yeah.
But what does it mean that we're the kind of being that can have such a existential break with the world as we know it, that people interpret that like an encounter with God? You know what I mean?
Yes.
So all of that suddenly becomes like, wow, well, I mean, if you're not interested in going there, fine, don't go there. But if you are, then how deep can we go, right?
That's just brilliant and amazing. I didn't even know this about your work or about your history. Yeah. Or about mystics. That's phenomenal. Yeah. Across time, across space, they're saying similar things about their encounter with God. Different languages, so they couldn't have read each other.
Yeah, the thing is, and there's a, I want to draw another connection here, because there is one, as weird as it may seem, to Leo Strauss, the scholar of the history of political philosophy.
Yeah, right.
But let me just set out the first thing here.
For people who don't know, the godfather of neoconservatism, for people who don't know, this is a very important guy, Leo Strauss. Yes.
Yeah, like back in the day at the time of the Iraq War, if you Google Leo Strauss, it would be like, Leo Strauss told neoconservatives to lie to the unwashed masses so that we, the elites, can go get blood for oil, etc. You know, it was like noble lies, because Strauss was a reader of Plato and Plato talked about noble lying. But the fact is that Strauss was the most eminent scholar of the history of political philosophy in the 20th century, if not of all time.
Yes.
A great man, a great teacher, and an inspiration for me in a big, big way. But the mystic thing.
Oh.
So imagine you have here a text all about being crucified with Christ, and here a text all about something else, okay, a different language. It required one step further to see that there's, okay, to entertain the hypothesis that they're saying the same thing in terms of the language that's available to them. So in other words, it was like you had to go slightly beneath the surface of just what's being said to the experience that's being spoken about. And you know what I mean? And makes sense that they could only use the terms they had available to them to convey that experience. And their terms were given to them by the tradition. So why I mention that, it gives us the difference between the surface and the depth of a text, the surface expression. If you didn't know that there, if you didn't entertain the hypothesis that there was a single underlying experience that was being interpreted differently, and all you had were the two different surfaces, you might think you're dealing with two completely different things. right? So now the way this maps over to Strauss on the history of political philosophy, I have to say briefly, because it's, I don't think I've said this explicitly anywhere else, but it's a nice connection to draw. So Strauss argued similarly that there is a human possibility that is the same at all periods of time, that man is not just a function of his time and place, like the historicists argued, or the cultural relativists argued, but there's some human experience that transcends time and place. Now, he did not say that it was the mystic experience. He said it was the experience of being philosophical. The experience of being philosophical means not a direct encounter with the absolute or something like we talked about on the mystic side of the equation, but it means raising a set of fundamental questions about the nature of the good life, the nature of the good society, what is justice, what is time, is the universe created or eternal? Fundamental questions. So Strauss's view is that if you read the history of political philosophy well, you will see, and I got to make this case, it's so beautiful, I'll try to be quick about it, but you'll see that underlying the apparent surface disagreements, and there are some, there's a fundamental underlying set of shared questions and concerns that transcend time and place.
Right.
Now, Strauss is famous, among other things, for this idea of esoteric writing, esoteric reading, the art of writing between the lines. So like a Straussian reading is one that treats an author as having said something other than he apparently said. Okay, Strauss had this view that authors in the history of political philosophy conceal their true teaching between the lines of their text. They have very many ways to do that. So deliberate contradictions, for example, repeating something they said in the text later in the text with a slight modification, all kinds of tricks, basically, that allow them to speak to different audiences at the same time, convey two different teachings in one in the same book or one in the same writing, and that we need to learn that way of reading them, okay? Now, here's the nice twist. He said, if you don't know that authors in the history of political philosophy sometimes pay lip service to the prevailing beliefs of their time, and you go read their books, you'll say, oh, look, Plato just reflected the prevailing beliefs of Greek culture because here they are. He invokes Zeus, you know, he swears by Zeus, therefore he believed in Zeus. Whereas once you entertain the possibility that the surface of their text pays lip service to the orthodoxy and the philosophical heterodox teaching is delivered between the lines of the text, then you see that there's this underground. The history of political philosophy, if it always pays lip service to the prevailing beliefs, might look like it's culturally relativistic. But when you dig beneath the surface of that, you see that the set of questions and concerns don't change. And that was his sort of refutation of historicism, part of it. Man. And yeah, it's weird that mysticism and Straussian political philosophy should have any commonality like that, because mystics typically are not doing like Straussian history of political philosophy, and Straussians typically are not doing like comparative study of existential mysticism. And yet I think that they belong together in a way.
Mikkel Thorup has spent more than 20 years living, traveling, and doing business in more than 100 countries all over the world. He's now the host of the Expat Money Show podcast, which is a complete guide to moving your life, your business, and your wealth offshore. By listening to the Expat Money Show, you'll learn how to live and do business in foreign countries and how to protect your money from government tax collectors. Mikkel will provide you with all the information you need to know about Plan B passports, legal tax mitigation, and asset protection. Right now, you can get a free special report just for unregistered listeners by going to expatmoneyshow.com/unregistered. Again, to get this free special report from Mikkel Thorup, go to expatmoneyshow.com/unregistered. So I have been trained for 56 straight years to believe that what you just said is total bullshit. Worse, it's superstitious bullshit. It's the kind of stuff that witch doctors traffic in, essentially, you know, or we historicists, and that, by the way, means most professional historians of any politics, but this is where we all agree. We think there's nothing transhistorical. And we have not seen any evidence until maybe now to suggest otherwise, because you can say that Plato was asking the same questions as Nietzsche, who was asking the same questions as Marx, who was asking the same questions as Richard Rorty.
But did they really ask the same questions? You know, first of all, they're not the same words. The sentence structure is not the same. Find me a sentence in Plato that's even similar to one in Marx, really. I mean, there's going to be massive differences in any sentence you pick for me. So where is this thing between the lines in the political philosophy and the great books in Plato's Republic and Beyond Good and Evil and Das Kapital? Where is this? When I read those books, where is this stuff you're talking about, the text between the lines?
Okay, so first of all, there's not a suggestion that they all answer the questions the same way. Okay, that Marx equals Nietzsche equals Plato equals Rorty.
Sure, I got that. Yeah.
The idea is that their fundamental question about what's the meaning of history? What's the meaning of time? What's the nature of the hole in which man finds himself? What's the nature of man as such? Does man find his essence in his doing or in his thinking? Do we reach our proper limits in terms of our contemplation or in terms of our ability to change the world? Like Kojève, the Hegelian philosopher who pulled on this thread that man is primarily action. He's an action that negates the given world, and he negates the given world on the basis of a project that doesn't yet exist. So all human life is characterized by our relation to nothing, that's that which doesn't exist, and our annihilating action, which transforms the given world on the basis of our desire. These are all accounts of what characterizes man and his relationship to the world in which he lives. And they're all answers to these fundamental questions. The answers may differ, but the question, what is the nature of the good society? What is the nature of the best regime? What's the nature of the political community? Why should property? You can find passages on the equalization of property in Aristotle's Politics, where he considers the legislators who proposed equalizing property. He considers that possible way of orienting society. What's good about it? What's bad about it? Why it works? Why it doesn't? Why do we need private property? What's the relationship between private property and the exercise of generosity or of magnanimity or of moderation, liberality? So the idea that Strauss tried to do was to excavate the underlying shared philosophical concern, even when it wasn't obvious on the surface of things. That's one way you could see it. So for example, I've been reading lately this book, Strauss's absolutely incredible Thoughts on Machiavelli. Hmm. And you see there, he says, for example, if you read, buddy here has read Machiavelli or will read Machiavelli, he sometimes mentions accidents. Okay. In his writing, he sometimes mentions accidents. And there's this kind of interpretation of how a statesman should take advantage of accidents or of chance or of things that just happen, how sometimes he may deliberately foster accidents to further his own purpose in something. And Strauss, just to give you one example, reminds us as we read this text that prior to Machiavelli, the scholastic tradition of Christian Aristotelianism had accident as a technical term in relationship to substance. So you always thought accident together with substance, whereas in Machiavelli, substance leaves the picture and we're just left with this technical term accident that's been forced into a new philosophical system. So once we can see that, and we need a great teacher like Strauss to help us to see that, to help us to read, as he writes about Machiavelli, people who have used this art of writing, where they just leave enough for the ultra careful readers to put the pieces of the puzzle together. And those who are fast readers, quick readers, and somehow not necessarily unserious, but who aren't going to penetrate into the hidden layer of the text. Well, the surface layer of the text is designed to deliberately rally them to some cause, indoctrinate them into some teaching, put them in some direction. It's kind of like, even you might say, the ideological versus the philosophical level of the text. So you don't have to take any of this, you don't have to take my word for any of it or take it on faith. The beautiful thing is that Strauss tried to demonstrate, you know, the merits of this way of reading texts in the history of political philosophy, and by their fruits you shall know them. So if his readings are fruitful, as I believe that they are, then we can entertain that thesis. But the worst thing to do would be to be like the professional historians that you suggested at the start of your comment and say, it can't be, it never was, that's ridiculous, impossible. Very simple. Those are the people who never mind the inner courtyard. They won't get into the outer courtyard. They won't even know that there's a courtyard. They'll just be off somewhere else. They have no chance of going further and further towards a possible holy of holies. They're just, No, the real witch doctors are the historians who have cast a spell on themselves, hypnotized themselves into believing that it's impossible there should be anything other than the flow of time and the flow of sources as they've come to know them.
You know, it's funny, Michael. I have been thinking recently, and I mean just in the last like 6 months to a year, that I might become religious. That the idea of God is no longer disdainful for me. And in fact, I've embraced it on a certain level. So the fact that we're talking about this, and I didn't even know we were going to talk about this today. I didn't know about this in your work. I didn't know this aspect of it at all. I'm wondering if, you know, by the end of this year, I'll be believing in God for the first time in my life. Maybe you'll help me get there. But it seems to me that that's what you're up to, brother. You're trying to make a case for God, aren't you?
Well, first of all, that's, I hope you get to say more about why you shifted and where you shifted and what shifted for you and what, where that ends up taking you and where you end up going with it. It's not my goal to proselytize. I'm not a, you know, I'm Jewish in a way. I'm not technically Jewish. It's a long story there, you know, and I have deep, deep sympathies with, as I said, Islamic mystics, Christian mystics, and mystics of all these traditions. And I have thoughts on, but I am not, what I would love to do, I give all the credit for what I do to my teachers. My two greatest teachers are Leo Strauss and Martin Heidegger. And what I credit them with is to put the deep questions in front of me that I couldn't see without their help. So what I try to share with my students, what I try to share in my work is giving us more and more of the big picture to think about what people do after that, where they go, what arguments strike them as reasonable, what questions attract them or repel them is out of my hands.
Okay, so name the great mystics. Who are the most famous mystics, the ones that you are talking about? Who are we talking about?
So you have Neoplatonists like Plotinus, for example, people who derived inspiration or impulse for their mystical philosophy on the back of Plato's teaching. Because, for example, in the Republic, in book 7, you have this idea that you turn around from the shadows on the wall. I mean, you've been turned around, you move from the shadows up the cave, out of the cave to the most beingful beings. The idea of the good represented in the sun. But then Plato has a phrase there about beyond being, that which is beyond being. So that is like a classical point where mystics from the Platonic tradition are like, wait a minute. You could say like one kind of religious ascent takes us from the shadows to the most beingful being, to the greatest being, to the supreme being, to being proper. But what about that extra step beyond being? What's that all about? And yet it's there. So that's like one kind of mysticism rooted in Plato. But then you have like Orthodox Christian mystical tradition.
Yeah.
Like Gregory Palamas, I think, is one of the important ones. Hesychasm, a kind of practice of mystical prayer. Repetition of named, like a mysticism of names. Pseudo-Dionysus, the Areopagite. I don't know exactly how to pronounce it. That's somebody I was reading back in the day, as well as Hermetic mystics and things. St. John of the Cross. Evelyn Underhill is a good scholar of Christian mysticism. Among Jewish thinkers, there's a mystical, several mystical tendencies. You could read Gershom Scholem on Kabbalists and things like that. But it's that whole realm taken together. You know, Plotinus was an important... For me personally, probably the most important ones were Neoplatonic mystics, the Eastern Orthodox mystics. It's not that I really studied them. I encountered a few of their phrases. I encountered a few of their texts. I encountered a few of their writings and it like pierced like an arrow, let's say. And someone I'd been reading recently that I thought was really nice on this is, and there's a Dugin connection, but he's a scholar. His name is Henri Corbin, C-O-R-B-I-N. He was the first person to translate fragments of Heidegger into French, but he also worked on Islamic thought and Islamic mysticism. So he's got a book called Creative Imagination in Ibn Arabi. Ibn Arabi's a medieval Islamic thinker. And a Russian guy named Vladimir Solovyov. So I remember like it was yesterday, I was walking through the library of the university I was at the time, and this book jumped off the shelf. It was called Vladimir Solovyov, Russian Mystic. Okay, Vladimir Solovyov, the beautiful thing about this Russian mystic, Vladimir Solovyov, is that he died in 1900, the same year Nietzsche died. And for me, it was always symbolic of the distance or the difference between East and West, because Solovyov and Nietzsche are two very different figures, and yet their lives overlapped to the point that they died in the same year. And you could try to triangulate to a certain extent the different meaning of Russia and the West, I think, maybe, by reading Nietzsche on one hand, Solovyov, this Russian mystic on the other hand, and trying to, like I say, triangulate to something beyond East and West, taken individually. But yeah, those are the kinds of, definitely the Russian, by the way, how I got into Dugin in a way, Alexander Dugin, was as an undergraduate with some Russian language background, because my parents came from the former Soviet Union, as I said, and this interest in mysticism, I began to become aware of the Russian tradition of religious thought, which tends to be more mystical and less rationalistic than the Western tradition. And so like Berdyaev, for example, Berdyaev was somebody that I was looking into at the time, just the school of Russian thinkers, Russian religious thinkers, all of whom have a mystical characteristic or quality to them. Mm-hmm. Solovyov was one of the main ones. So I thought, I'm going to learn Russian and start translating. The first person I had planned to translate was Vladimir Solovyov. I also planned to translate this guy named Nikolai Fyodorov. He's a futurist. So I wanted to do work on Russian futurists and cosmists. But I ended up reading an article about Dugin called Alexander Dugin, Prophet of a New Russian Empire, which said, this is where all the threads came together. Mm-hmm. It said, here's a philosopher who is extremely influential at the Kremlin. He'd recently been kicked, as of the time of this article, he'd recently been kicked out of Ukraine. And as a result, Vladimir Putin expelled the Ukrainian ambassador, meaning that Dugin was so high profile a philosopher that there was political, that they had his back politically, which was just interesting to me.
Wow.
Because it's like a philosopher king type configuration.
Yeah.
You know, political philosopher at the peak of his game.
Right.
And the article also said that Dugin had this background in occult mysticism. And furthermore, that you couldn't understand Russia without understanding Dugin. So it was like, boom, boom, boom. All the lights went off. Philosopher king, Plato, political philosophy, mysticism, occultism, understanding Russia, Russian language. Bam. That was like the start for me of working on Dugin.
Holy crap. Okay. So we're going to talk about Dugin. But before we do that, I want to finish on this mysticism thing. And my turn toward God, maybe, that might be happening. So I think the answer to the question you asked me about why I've been moving in that direction toward religion, being at least sympathetic to religion and being very open to the possibility of God. I think I can actually probably answer that question by asking you about your initial experience. You talked about this at the beginning of the interview about that was the first thing that turned you on intellectually was mysticism. And you said some things when you were describing that that suggest that you and I have something similar in our relationship with mysticism, spirituality, religion, God. Can you talk about your first encounter with it? And what was it personally for you, psychologically for you, that was so appealing? I have some guesses, but go ahead.
Okay. I'll tell you, I remember the exact moment where I knew that I had been dialed in to this realm or domain.
Whoa.
Okay, I'm going to tell the story really quickly, okay?
Yeah.
My parents divorced and I moved to the States. I was going to school in Michigan. I was like 15, 16 years old, okay? So I moved to the States with my mom and I was going to school there. I wasn't a great student, okay? I wasn't trying very hard in class. I wasn't, you know, skipping some classes, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. We had an English class and we were reading The Transcendentalists, okay? Emerson and Thoreau. Mm-hmm. The teacher came to class and he said, class, today's a very special and strange day. I had a student write on this topic pretty much like even better than my answer key. You know, so he's given this talk about anybody who wants to check their understanding of transcendentalism should just come and read this student's paper. So I was sitting there with my head down, not even thinking, because we had a super smart guy in the class who was always like, he's getting the best marks on everything and he's the go-to guy and he's the super genius. And then the professor said, you know, Michael Millerman. And I didn't know until that moment that somehow I have a facility in dealing with this world of transcendental mysticism and that kind of thing. And that I'm just, I found myself later in life. I mean, I don't want to go into too many details because it's obviously not about me in this case. It's about the subject matter, about the authors, and about the experiences. But you could say that I had many cases in my life. In fact, if it wasn't overly presumptuous of me to do, I would continue working on my little mystical memoir. Many experiences in my life where the guiding thread was something having to do with mysticism, transcendence, and that kind of thing, more than just conceptually, let's say. So very much like an orienting theme in a hero's journey type configuration, you know, in other words, a guiding thread of my life. But that was the moment where it was clear to me that, okay, like, I mean, it wasn't, I was just weird. Like, why should it have been the case that this topic that was super, it wasn't super easy for me because I'm smart or something. Like I said, I wasn't particularly great. I wasn't the best student in class. I was just maybe because of the divorce or whatever, right? Whatever. Mm-hmm. But understanding and feeling into and living with and being in the realm of the transcendentalists and later of the mystics, and probably this applies to my facility with Heidegger, my interest in Heidegger, my work on Heidegger, just being able to get in there and being able to live as though there's a destiny unfolding. You know, somehow that was just there for me. But that's when it became clear to me. Yeah, that's a weird way of putting it, but that's like in the background of everything. It's in the background of my life in a big way. But I can't point to it. Like, I can point to many there are many moments of my life where the presence of the mystical reality was there, let's say. Mm-hmm. Okay. But the one where the light dawned on me was with the transcendentalists in that English class back in the day.
When you were a teenager in high school.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before you encountered the dry, barren halls of academe, you know, where they have where they have excised much of human life. We don't study much of human life in universities anymore, right? We don't study. We're not interested in, you know, things like what you're talking about. And that's, I think, where I'm going here. When you first started talking about your attraction to mysticism, you said something that Dugin said to me when I interviewed him, which is that, in so many words, you both said mysticism and that tradition captures, or at least attempts to comprehend, all of human existence.
Oh, yeah.
All of the experiences. It seeks to understand, at least, and provide answers to everything we feel, everything we think, everything that happens to us, both intentionally and accidentally. They are curious about that. And of course, they have all sorts of different answers. And I don't care if they're right or wrong about the answers. What's important to me is that they care about these feelings, which is really, I think, really what it is, that university professors trained in the Enlightenment tradition of rationalism and science and logic are not only uninterested in, they're hostile to it, because it challenges at the most fundamental level, which is our fucking feelings, the entire Enlightenment project and all of modernity. Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. The mystic gesture, like in some other cases, is all comprehensive. It aims for, like in Solovyov's turn, all unity and everything taken together. It's tries to put us, yeah, absolutely, into a sort of comprehensive. And one beautiful thing, again, just to make, I want to make this surprising connection because I'm surprised by it coming up for me as a result of our conversation. Strauss, in Political Philosophy, says that there's the notion of the regime, of the comprehensive political community. And he recovers that in his study of Plato and Aristotle. And what he says is the regime has fallen out of analysis in political science in the same way that all unity, I add, has fallen out of our study, the mystic comprehensiveness that is ignored at the universities is akin to the comprehensiveness of the political community called the regime that's ignored in departments of political science. And the opposite gesture, the way away from that atomization, or the way away from specialization, from narrowing our horizons, from constraining our vision, from keeping our heads down so we can only look at the dirt and at the dust, and allowing us to see the big picture. Mystics are about the big picture. Strauss and Heidegger, each in their own way, is about the big picture, putting that back. Dugin, as you know, people who watch your interview will know, the breadth and the depth of his interests, of his questions, of the authors that he draws on. So you could say the whole gesture here is reversing narrow specialization, atomization, and constraint, and going back to majestic gestures that are comprehensive, all-embracing, and crucially, not just horizontally, also vertically. We want the heights and the depth and the breadth of human existence.
Okay. I'm still a little bit skeptical about this. And I'm going to find out if the mystics are for me. You ready? It's a simple question. Michael, what do they say about sex? Fairly important thing in human experience, right? Fairly important thing. Many of us think it's kind of central. So have the mystics been as interested in sex and sexuality as they have been in, oh, God?
Yeah, but what does interest in sexuality look like? You know, like how do we characterize an interest in sexuality?
Yeah.
So for sure, some of them, let's say, allegorize romantic coupling, right? Not all of them are against the pleasures of the flesh. Okay. Many of them use the pleasures of the flesh as they don't just allegorize it, you know, they embrace it and they mysticize on the back of it, so to speak. Okay. So that's going to vary a little bit from person to person. But one of the things is that how could you put it? Imagine that we have some feeling realm, like you put it, feelings. Mm-hmm. And usually our feelings are linked to sense perception, sex, taste, touch. Mm-hmm. Pretty basic, right? Mm-hmm. Taste and touch. And we say only when we dial down the volume on those sensory inputs can we be receptive to some inner sense.
That's right.
Okay. So you dial one down, you dial the other one up in order to become receptive. That's a completely comprehensible type of operation.
Yep.
But then you ask the additional question, or you can ask the additional question, okay, once you've done that, once you've dialed one down, dialed the other one up, does it mean that you have to be celibate? Does it mean that you have to hate sex? Does it mean that you have to be very dismissive of the pleasures of taste and touch? Or do they all begin to take on a new significance without being diminished for what they are?
Right.
In the Jewish tradition, for sure, like people don't suddenly, you know, every Shabbat Jews drink wine and there's all kinds of wine poetry. And some of the most beautiful mystic poetry you'll see is very sensuous, very beautiful, sensuous Islamic love poems and things like that, Persian love poems. So in my view, it's does not need to culminate in hatred for the body, for sensuality, for sexuality. Not at all. In my view, the cup runneth over. So as much as our human life as can contain the splendors of that inner dimension, outwardly in an embodied life, you know, like there are the mystics who pull themselves out of a life fully lived. But I feel more kinship with those mystics who bring that what they discovered into their lives and live it fully. So that means in their sex, in their work, in their play, in their hustle, in everything that they do.
Okay, fine. I believe in God. You win. Listen, we got to talk about the thing I thought we were going to talk about mostly here, which is your relationship with Alexander Dugin and what that has meant for your career. So you had the same experience that I did. You essentially got fired from academia. You were told that you did not belong here. You should not teach our beautiful young minds, and you are a dangerous person. But let's tell that story. So how did you find out about Dugin?
It was that article, Alexander Dugin, Prophet of a New Russian Empire, that I was reading. The journal is called Azure. I don't know that they exist anymore. All kinds of nice, interesting connections there, because it was co-founded by a guy named Yoram Hazony, who works on nationalism. He's got a book called Virtue of Nationalism. He hates Dugin. He hates Heidegger. And yet it was in his journal that I found out about Dugin and became like the leading Dugin guy. But that's just a historical accident. So yeah, I read that article. I was very interested in it. And then I started Googling. Like, this was 2011, I think.
And you were in were you in graduate school?
No, I was undergraduate. Undergraduate Department of Philosophy at University of British Columbia. And I started just doing a little bit of digging. Great article. So I was like hooked. I wanted to learn more about him. And one of the first things that I found was about a short 5-minute speech of his on this idea called the fourth political theory. It was the first time I'd heard it.
Right.
And he says, in a nutshell, you had liberalism, communism, and fascism fighting in the 20th century. Liberalism was the last ideology standing. What if you want to oppose liberalism and you don't want to do it as a communist or a fascist? You have no place to stand. And yet, if all three of liberalism, communism, and fascism are spent forces, we need to declare the space of a fourth political theory. I thought that was pretty compelling. It was short. It was sweet. It was just like I presented it to you now, structurally made sense to me. And it also helped me to explain something I had been noticing, which was that whoever was criticizing liberalism, not from the left, was automatically being called a fascist.
Yep.
Even if it's obvious that they're not fascists.
Right.
So Dugin's model explained that. If you only think in terms of liberalism, communism, and fascism, and you're criticizing liberalism not from the left, ipso facto, you're a fascist.
Right.
So I thought, okay, well, since the people I'm interested in are obviously not fascists, but they're criticizing liberalism not from the left, this idea of a fourth political theory is intriguing to me. So next thing I did is I went on the Wikipedia page that he had at the time, and I went to the Russian version of it, and I noticed he had a book in Russian called The Fourth Political Theory. So I just heard him give a 5-minute talk on it. Then I saw he had a book on it. And I proposed to my Russian language supervisor, let me translate this book. Because I mentioned I wanted to start translating Russian philosophy in order to learn technical Russian terminology, technical Russian philosophical terminology. So he said, my supervisor said, pick an old philosopher and a living philosopher. For the old one, I picked this futurist. And for the new one, I picked Dugin on the basis of what I just told you, his 5-minute talk and the fact that he's alive and had a book called The Fourth Political Theory. As it happens, I never got to the futurist because I just continued working on Dugin over the pretty much decade now. So I started translating his book, The Fourth Political Theory. And my supervisor was like, this is 2011. So Putin had just announced the creation of a Eurasian Economic Union. And here I was translating the ideologist of Eurasianism, neo-Eurasianism. Wow. So my supervisor's like, every time I brought a translation to him, he was like, this is amazing. This is literally like, you're doing something extremely valuable here, he said to me. And he said, have you considered reaching out to Dugin about getting this published? I hadn't, but since he suggested it, I did. And Dugin said that he already has a publisher in the US getting ready to publish The Fourth Political Theory. Someone else had been translating it in parallel. So the press, Arctos, said, why don't we put together what we have already completed with what you've completed and push it out for this July 2012 conference that had been around the corner. So that is how my translation of The Fourth Political Theory was combined with someone else's. I became the co-translator of the first Dugin book to be released in English. And that has, I think, opened up some doors for the study of Dugin in English. And then I just kept translating his books after that, one after another, because they were interesting to me. Yeah, my university didn't take too kindly to this association with Putin's brain and the most dangerous philosopher in the world. I'll just add one piece of the puzzle here. In 2014, I was invited onto Canadian TV to give an interview on Putin's brain. So 2014 is when Russia-Ukraine was last a hotspot. Okay, that's when you had the war in Eastern Ukraine and Donbass and all of that. And I was working on Dugin. And I was invited to give an interview on Ontario TV in Canada, okay? But it was the only time that anybody had in a televised forum explained the Russian perspective without all kinds of liberal distortions. And so the clip went viral, you know? But I think for this kind of topic, it was viral. Like over 100,000 people have watched it by now. And after that interview, I got called into many offices and I got many a finger wagging and I had four professors resign from my dissertation committee and I was accused of being a Russian agent and I was told, you know, I'd never work in this town again, that kind of thing. And people tried to sabotage my funding. And basically, there was a big blowback. And that blowback lasted for several years as I barely managed to finish my PhD because there was a war against me. And you know how these things go.
I do.
But that's, people were not keen on having, you know, the amazing thing is that professors, And you know such professors and your listeners know such professors and such people who pride themselves on diversity, on otherness, on studying the other, on the, as long as it's the right kind of other. As soon as you study the wrong kind of other, namely a Russian conservative, who, as you know, you spoke to him, he's other. He's other,
Oh, yeah.
right?
Oh yeah.
He's very other, but he's the wrong kind of other. So if you go there, right-wing anti-liberalism, Russian conservatism, mm-hmm. German conservative revolution. That is the wrong kind of other. All the tolerance for diversity goes out the window, mm-hmm. and all the apparatus of repression and reputation destruction and everything else you can think of goes into high gear.
Alexander Dugin is the philosopher of diversity. That's what he stands for. That's what his work is. He is for diversity. And to me, he's an anti-imperialist. To me, that's what sort of unites all of his ideas. It's a remarkable what they did to you. You had a much bloodier, nastier exit from the academy than I did. Mine was pretty bad, but yours was much worse. I mean, while you were writing the dissertation, they were fully at war with you. Four of your professors on your committee resigned from your dissertation committee.
Yeah, that's right. So over the years, I had four dissertation committee members resign. But the most despicable act, in my view, was that several years after one of them had resigned. So they resigned. They all signed off on my dissertation project, which included my work on Dugin. They all knew about my work on Dugin going in. And then they panicked or freaked out and reacted in the way that they did. But several years after that, when I was still in the course of my PhD, one of the people who resigned was making phone calls behind my back to the new members on my committee, telling them not to work with me and trying to sabotage the committee. So in some cases successfully, and in other cases he was told to go to hell by people with a spine. But the idea that they could be so invested in sabotaging my work, and I should add, just so that there's no confusion about this, I graduated top of my class. My student reviews were over 90% for all of the 5 years that I was there. Yeah. And eventually I did win a major national scholarship for my research. So that's not like I was a shitty teacher and a bad scholar.
Of course.
Excuse me, sir.
You currently are charging a lot of money for people to take your courses online on philosophy. Okay. Guess what those motherfuckers can't do? They can't charge a dime, because no one wants to take their courses. So you've demonstrated already as an entrepreneur that you are superior as a teacher and a thinker and a scholar to them. You've proven it, because people spend their money on you.
Right. There's directly. No degree at the end of the tunnel at the Millerman School, and people go because they want to learn. They want the questions without the ideological baggage that they're getting at the universities, just as you know, hence the success of Renegade University. Yeah. So it was a blessing in disguise. I consider it probably the same for you, because getting blacklisted from academia meant getting greenlighted for this independent alternative, which I think is the future. I mean, a lot of people are signaling that the universities are beyond repair, but the desire to learn is not beyond repair. It just needs to be satisfied elsewhere than the universities. And the crucial thing, in my view, is that people know, let's say you've given up on the universities. Okay, fine. And now you want another alternative. Okay, that's legitimate. Well, the alternative should preserve what's best about the old university, in my view. And one of the things that's best about it was there used to be extremely competent, passionate expositors of important works and topics. In other words, the quality of instruction should remain very high. Just because we turn our backs on academia doesn't mean that we want a free-for-all, in my view, right? So there's a great opportunity there. You've stepped into it, Justin Murphy and myself, and I see other people making the move. Mm-hmm. And it was a blessing in disguise.
Yeah. When I found out about you, which is a month or two ago, you tweeted a nice thing about RU. And I said, who is this guy? And I looked you up. I said, there's a Millerman School. Who is? And it turned out you had the same story. And you and I talked, you know, you and Justin Murphy and I, I'm pretty sure this is true, we're the first to do this kind of thing. We're the first ex-academics to put up our own schools online and in person, in the case of RU, and be successful and make a living on it. So, you know, we are the pioneers of what I am totally sure is going to be the future of higher education and education generally. I don't have any doubt about that. And I think that for many, many, many universities and colleges, certainly in this country, many of them, their days are numbered, not just because of us, but in part because of us, because we will literally be taking their students and their instructors. I mean, I have professors at universities asking me for jobs. Often this happens. And we have many, many people at RU who have a .edu email address, meaning they're currently enrolled as students at a regular university, but they're much more interested in what we do and what you do. So yeah, this is the future. I'm really proud of it. And I was really proud to meet you and to know that this is happening and that there's more than one of us. When I found that out, as I told you, I got so excited deep in my bones when I was talking to you about this, because when I found out that there was someone doing this who was successful at it, and you had no platform like, unlike me, I had, you know, books and I was had a podcast and I was, you know, around, I was on Joe Rogan. You had none of that, you know, but you still managed to sell, you know, these courses because you're so damn good, which is what should happen. The revenge, our revenge is going to be so sweet because it's being served very cold, which is in the form of cash being paid to us for people who want to learn about ideas and who don't want to be lectured at and who don't want to have their ideas dismissed and told that there's only one way of thinking and that their feelings shouldn't be talked about. And the mysticism is bullshit and should be right. So this is huge.
Yeah. Students have had the experience. They've told me, and I'm sure you've heard many cases where ideology creeps in, doesn't even creep in. It's in their face in situations that absolutely don't call for it. I remember in many cases, I was in a political science intro class and there would just be offhand jokes about Republicans, about conservatives, about any kind of idea like that. And it becomes a noxious environment. It becomes incompatible with a place where people can genuinely think. And it doesn't mean that, as you know about your school and as I can say about my school, we're not in the business of offering a counter ideology. It's a place where there can be questions on the table and intelligent people thinking about them and discussing them. The university used to be, so far as I know, a place where you could have that to a certain extent, but it has become a place where you can't. And so we're stepping into that very important role where people want to think, they want to meet other people who are thinking, they know these books are important. They know that just to read something isn't to agree with it, just to entertain a thought is not to be a slave to that thought or a champion of that thought. This whole guilt by association logic that makes it impossible for someone even to pick up a book to know what's in it. Because if you're seen holding it, you're already on the blacklist. That's made the universities just a place of suffocation instead of what they should be, a place of intellectual liberation. So yeah, it is a great opportunity. And it's been for me a real privilege and a pleasure to meet people like yourself, the students who are going to our classes, people in and out of academia, just like you say. One of the things that was so surprising to me after my falling out at the university is I constantly, like daily, got letters from students and academics who wanted to know more. This was before I set up the school. They were, what can you tell me about Dugin? Can you say a little bit more about Strauss? What's this? Like, there was a interest that students and professors had in these questions that they knew could never be entertained at the university, but that were still totally legitimate, relevant, interesting, all of that. So it's only fair that people should have a place where they can do that. And that's what we're offering. That's what you're offering. Justin Murphy, in his own way, he's had great teachers come into his school, and I know he's going to be doing great work going ahead. And we may be the first, we won't be the last. Obviously, there are going to be other people setting up their educational institutions. And thank God, it's great. There should be opportunities for people to learn and opportunities for teachers to earn, like we're doing, and to give other teachers an opportunity to work. Nice financial incentives, no administrative nightmares, no ideological ball and chain that won't allow you to, just like Plato's cave, you know, that won't allow you to turn your head towards the light. I think if we can give students an opportunity to read great books and talk about them, teachers an opportunity to lecture about what they're great about, and ourselves an opportunity to have a living, an income, a business, and to contribute what we're passionate about, where's the problem? It's a win-win, right? It's win-win all around the board.
I just need a moment. That was so beautifully put. I'm just, wow. Thank you for that. Just thank you. Wow. It's really happening. You know, it's really happening. Like, wow. Thank you. We are going to do with you a lot of things. You're going to teach for us. You're going to teach a course on Heidegger. We are going to do a conference on the crisis of liberalism with you, hopefully, we think, and maybe others, and maybe Mr. Dugin, actually. And we're going to continue changing the world. This is really something. Michael Millerman, this has been a hell of an interview.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation, and thanks for what you're doing.
God bless you. Thank you, Michael. We will be in touch very soon.
Sounds good. I appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To join the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. to join the new Unregistered Underground, the supporting listeners group for the podcast, go to unregisteredunderground.com. Thanks for